So, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Good morning. Boker Tov. And today's portion, of course, is Behar, followed by Bechukotai, which has to do... Behar is interesting, right? Just simply means on or in the mountain. So on Mount Sinai is the Har, the mountain that they're talking about being on or in. And the things that happen here, of course, are the things that they were told on Mount Sinai. And what strikes me about that, and this is the way I'm gonna introduce it, because there's always all this argument and discussion about, well, does it apply or does it not apply? Clearly it says here that when you're in the land, there are some things you're gonna do. We're not in the land. The people that were hearing this were not in the land. The commandments have to do with when you're in the land, there are certain things you're going to do. And so, if they were in the land, if we were in the land, these things would be requirements. The point is, and this is where I get, you know, a little bit logically anal retentive, if we're not in the land, it doesn't mean that they have to be done, nor does it mean that they can't be done, and it certainly doesn't indicate, and here's where I'm going to just be a little bit over the top, that there might not be some value in doing it anyway, in terms of training or in terms of all kinds of other things, because what I want to spend most of the time today is talking about is patterns. There are certain things that are commandments while we're in the land. If we want to go back into the land, it might be a good idea to learn them now and get in the habit, okay? No question on that score, I will suggest. Also, there are patterns that repeat, and this portion, probably more than any other pattern portion in the parshas in all of Torah, is at the top of the heap. We see sevens upon sevens upon sevens in here, patterns of sevens. If we can't understand this idea of pattern, I think we miss a whole lot. So, I want to also throw out this idea that in this portion is a little bit of what I'm going to call Torah economics, and it's not Torah Econ 101. Torah Econ 101, right? That's the first introductory level college class. That's the simple stuff. Honest weights and measures, I think, would be in that category. Even though, of course, nowadays we've gotten so many lies, piled upon lies on that score, most people don't know what an honest weight and measure is, or that money is supposed to be a measure or a weight of something like silver. Right. But anyway, that would be Torah 101. I'm going to suggest that what we're talking about here is Torah, probably about 301. Because it, again, has to do with patterns, and it has to do with this thing that's called the Shemitah, and then the Yovel year. I always like to mention that, right in the beginning of this portion, you see this idea of the Jubilee, proclaim liberty throughout the land. It's the words that were famously written on the Liberty Bell in Pennsylvania and have been pretty well forgotten. Proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. Well, part of the problem, of course, is we don't teach Torah 101 anymore. So for crying out loud, why would we expect anybody to know about Torah 301? Why am I suggesting that the pattern here is important? Well, you've heard me talk about this before if you've heard me work through this portion. I'm not going to belabor it today. I'm simply going to mention it. There are all kinds of things in the Torah that would be covered in a 300-level class that have to do with what is it about the time value of money? What about interest rates? What about usury? All those kind of things. Who can and who can't you charge usury to? Of course, if you don't even have honest weights and measures, what are we arguing about, right? Debt. What happens with debt? Well, debt has this interesting problem associated with it, and this is essentially the gist of where I want to at least start today with the Torah 301 concept. Debt compounds. And what you find, and you see it throughout history, you see it in the Torah, and you certainly see it throughout the world today, people fall into debt and they dig themselves a hole, and then they tend to get worse and worse and worse. We've institutionalized it in most of the Western world today, especially in the United States, where I just saw the story yesterday, the bunch of college kids that are coming out of what laughably now passes for school with a negative education. In other words, they paid lots and lots of money to learn things that are wrong in most cases. So they got stupider rather than getting wiser, and they have negative learning, which has to be unlearned before they're any good for anything. But worse still, they're in the hole economically too. The current college crowd graduating this year has the highest debt levels of college debt in history, say the stories. That shouldn't surprise us. So not only are they in the hole when it comes to knowledge, they're in the hole when it comes to money that doesn't even amount to real money anyway. Oh, for crying out loud, what a mess. And guess what? All of this stuff tends to build up and build up and build up. Now, if we had a lot of time, I could basically take you through and show you there's an interesting pattern that you see in economic history, too. And that is, we tend to get a Great Depression about every 70 years or so, approximately a human lifespan. This, too, is a cycle that repeats. In other words, debt builds up in a society, and then eventually all the debt gets to be bad. It can't be paid back anymore. What do? They go bankrupt. They default. And they give their stuff to somebody else who holds the note, usually for pennies on the dollar. And the system falls apart. People get out of work. They lose their homes, their jobs, their factories, their farm equipment, their land. Oh, it's a mess. But eventually the slate gets cleared. Things start over again. The debt gets wiped away because it just plain vanishes. And then they start rebuilding again. And it takes about a human lifetime. My joke for years has been, all the people that made the bad mistakes that got themselves into that kind of problem have to die. And then once they're all dead, then the people who didn't learn the things to begin with and didn't hear from their dad, hey, don't do that, son, it's really stupid and it'll cost you your house or your job or whatever, well, they do the same things again. They fall back into the same trap and the cycle repeats. So essentially, you see these depressions happening about every human lifetime or so, every 70-ish years, when all the people that went through the Great Depression in the 1930s are no longer able to tell their kids and their grandkids, this is really dumb what we're doing, don't do it, and they do it anyway. So what's interesting about the Yovel, right, 7 times 7, is it's a reset lever. Now, as an engineer, I know that in all you guys that have had computers have known this. You've got a power-on reset, called Control-Alt-Delete. You just every now and then, things get messed up, computer quits working right, you hit Control-Alt-Delete, you pull the power plug, shut her down, reboot it. And that's exactly what the Yovel does. Oh, wait a minute, Mark, it's only for in the land. Hey, come on. Does human nature apply outside the land? Can you not see that the patterns, yeah, they're mandatory in the land, but the patterns are still kind of good, and if you don't at least learn the lessons, that's why I like the word instruction for Torah much better than law. Yeah, there are commandments and statutes and judgments, hokim, mishpatim, mitzvot, all kinds of things in there that are you shall and you shall not do various things. But more importantly, it's about instruction. And it's the instruction that is really valuable. And even if we're not in the land, I will contend, there are some lessons here, folks, we better be taken to heart. And one of those lessons that I will suggest we're seeing play out in the news, we'll come back to this, is if you don't pull the reset lever every, 50 years or so, things just get worse and worse and worse. And then essentially, if you want to put it this way, the universe, since people don't want to ascribe the bad things to God, pulls the plug itself. The Creator simply instructed us to the fact that, hey, if you don't pull the plug, it's going to pull itself. Just bear that in mind. So now we're far enough into this. I've already mentioned a couple of things. This pattern of sevens is fascinating. We see the pattern of sevens over and over and over again through Scripture. For that reason, a lot of scholars, and I don't disagree, have said, hey, you know, this number seven seems to represent in the economy, in the mathematics of Yah, some kind of concept of completion. World was completed in 6 days, rested on the seventh. We see the Shemitah year, rest for the land every 7 years. Then we get a pattern of 7 times 7 years that has to do with pulling the giant reset lever on the economy. People return to the lands and so forth. When they're in the land, they return to their land. We're going to see other patterns of seven. When we get to the curses place in this parsha, interestingly, it's 7 times 7 for the Yovel. And then what we see is for the curses, it's 7, and if you don't listen, 7 times more. And if you still won't listen, 7 times more. If you still won't listen, fury comes upon you, 7 times more. So it's literally 7 times 7 times 7 times 7. Fascinating stuff. The pattern here is what I want to focus on. And with that, I came up with a title for this as I was thinking about it literally just a couple minutes ago. I want to call this particular discussion, rather than just simply Bahar and Behukotai, let's call it the tree people versus the forest people. You ever heard that expression before? People saying, I'm a tree person. I'm a forest person. Well, folks, if you haven't figured it out, I'm pretty much what you call a forest person. I like to see the forest as opposed to being so deep in the woods that you can't see the forest for the trees. That's where the expression comes from. In other words, if you're in the forest, sometimes you got to kind of take a step back. Well, maybe it's partly because I'm a pilot, right? I'd rather fly over the forest and look down and see all the trees. And from up above, if you look at the whole forest rather than the trees, now you can begin to see bigger patterns. All right, so there you go. That's the concept. I'm going to suggest that while a lot of us are naturally forest people, others of us are naturally tree people, and hey, there ain't nothing wrong with that, it is important to have both perspectives from time to time. Sometimes, if your goal is to, diagnose what's wrong, why a particular tree is dying, well, it's good to be a tree person. You got to focus in on the specifics. If the tree needs to be removed because you're trying to build something or it's diseased or whatever, hey, it's good to be a tree people. But on the other hand, there are times when, of course, it's handy to have a different perspective. If it is not natural to us to adopt one or the other of those perspectives, it's I will suggest a good habit to get into, to be able to step back and say, all right, what is the bigger picture? Now, that's part of the reason why I get so upset about the concept of metaphor, too, and the idea that, well, a metaphor means this, it can't mean something else. And on that score, I think it's no surprise, I heartily disagree. A metaphor is a teaching tool. It is instruction. To the extent that it is useful to help our understanding, great. And to the extent that, if we start saying the metaphor cannot mean something else, my perspective then becomes, well, who says? The creator of the universe maybe used this metaphor. For example, Yah calls himself any number of things that we as humans can relate to. He says he is, in various contexts through various prophets, he is a king. He is a master. He is a creator. He is a father, even. And he is a husband. All of those metaphors are used. They all add value to our understanding. Do any of them completely describe him? Of course not. That's silly. The whole point of a metaphor is to say something is something else. Right? If it's a simile, it's something is like something else. So he's saying, I am a father, I am a king, I am a master, I am a husband, I am a creator. Well, the common thing there, I will contend, well, there's a lot of them. And it's good to look at the common things. That's part of seeing the pattern. Part of the common element to all of those things is it's a one-to-many relationship. In other words, there's one of him, and there's many of us. One father can have more than one wife, more than one child. One king has more than one subject, for sure. One master can have more than one servant. And one creator, of course, can create more than one thing. Lots and lots and lots and lots of things. So the pattern is consistent. We learn from the metaphor. The question is, are we able to step outside the box and just simply say, what is it the Creator is trying to teach us here? And at the point where we start limiting him and saying, oh, he can't possibly mean this, I think probably we're closing off our minds. We're not willing to step outside the trees and take a look from the forest. Now, I want to illustrate that with one other concept here, too, because there's another verse from Ecclesiastes. Wonderful book of wisdom. Whoever wrote this book kind of had a pretty good handle on certain things. He describes in Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11, something that I call the lag effect. And it goes like this, and I'll read it in the King James. It says, or the New King James, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. Therefore, the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Now, what's he saying? You know what? It means sometimes people do bad things. And bad stuff happens to people who do bad things, right? You reap what you sow. The problem is it takes a while. And, you know, I remember the famous line from Thomas Jefferson. I'm a very old man, a very young gardener. Gardening is tough. It takes a while. You plant things and then things grow. You know what else? Some other things have longer patterns still. Stuff that happens in the soil might take several years before it develops. Potato farmers will tell you, without doing some things, you can't keep planting potatoes year after year in the same place. Hey, maybe that has to do with this idea of the Shemitah and why it's not only instruction that's valuable in the land, because farmers have known for a long time crop rotation is important. There's kind of a 7-year cycle there, and it's a good thing to do. They'll tell you, if you're not going to rotate your crops, let the land lie fallow every 7 years or so. Amazing. Now, does that mean that's why God did this? No, that's presumptuous. That's saying we know what his entire plan is, and we don't have his mind. But it's fine for us to say, oh, look, in his instruction, if we will see the patterns, if we'll step back from the patterns, we can learn a whole lot. Even if we're not required to do something because we're not in the land, nevertheless, the instruction is valuable to us. Seeing the patterns of seven is valuable to us. And again, it's a difference between realizing that something is not necessarily a requirement, but the instruction can help us see the forest for the trees. Now, one more comment about Bahar as I'm working through this idea of the patterns of seven and what all of this means and what we ought to be able to take away from it this week. Because this is the other thing that you'll certainly hear. It's one of the complaints I have against modern ex-Christianity. Oh, that old stuff is done away with, doesn't matter anymore. And I'm thinking, the whole theme of this Parsha, and indeed both of them here, it's a double Parsha. And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe Behar Sinai, saying, speak to the children of Israel, tell them all this stuff. When you come into the land, do this. Well, you know what? Think about this for a second. Most of the people, Behar, on that particular day, the vast majority of the adults, all except for two, Caleb and Joshua, were going to die. Their carcasses were going to fall in the wilderness. You know what, folks? They were never, ever going to live in that land. So what good is it to them? I might as well just ignore this. You know, I'm never going to be in the land. I'm going to die. And whether they knew that or not doesn't matter. The point is, it was never going to apply to them. So, the modern thinking would be, well, it's useless knowledge. Has no purpose whatsoever. And I'd say, wrong. And by the way, it's still wrong, because if you step back and look at history, ask yourself, out of the 6,000 years or so of recorded human history, how long has man been in the land? How long were they allowed to live in the land before they got sanded off and whacked and basically sent into exile? First the Northern Kingdom, then the Southern Kingdom. Answer, a fraction. Literally a tiny fraction. And if you actually look at it in terms of human beings, you know, you've heard the old saying, more people are alive today than have been alive for the last 5,000 years for sure. Pre-flood? Maybe there's some question on that score. But certainly, the vast majority of people who have ever lived could say the same thing. We're never going to enter the land. A lot of folks are going to die. A lot of folks aren't going to ever make it. A lot of folks have already died and never made it. So, hey, why bother? Why bother with all this stuff? In the days before airplanes, right, if you're walking through the forest, why would you ever want to be anything but a tree person? You can't very well fly up above if you don't have an airplane and look down on the forest, can you? Well, you can, literally. We can use the instruction. We can use our understanding of patterns and cycles. And that's, by the way, part of the reason why I spend so much time talking about cycles and why, as an engineer, cycles fascinate me. And resonance, and I talk sometimes, I get nerdy about the math and how the cycles repeat. And if you ever stood at a seashore and you'll see patterns of waves come in. You can time the waves, but then you notice that there are bigger patterns of bigger waves, and the waves build up, and the waves literally can cancel each other out. Sound can do the same thing. If you've ever seen the noise-canceling headphones, it's cool stuff. I remember reading a sci-fi story about it years ago, and then designing the circuits to do it. You just basically see the noise that you want to eliminate. You get the pattern. It's kind of like how a surfer times the waves, right? I time the wave. I look. Come. Okay. In, out. Or how a little girl gets ready to jump rope. You've seen a little girl. Moves her hands. Moves her body. I'm getting ready to go. Get ready to go. One, two, three. Go! Jump! Two, three, four. And they go. So if you can design something that will time the noise cycle, like if it's an engine, if it's a repetitive cycle, and you just take and you turn it upside down and you create anti-noise that is precisely out of phase, and then you mix it together, pump it through the headphones, the noise and the anti-noise cancel out, and it's quiet. Really cool. It's all about seeing the pattern, recognizing the pattern repeats, and stepping outside the box a bit and saying, will that really work? Yeah, it does. The instruction can apply. Back to Ecclesiastes. If you don't get the patterns, you miss. And this is what this guy is wisely saying here. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. This is lag. In other words, because it takes a while for the bad things you've done to hit you before the evil fruit of that particular seed is reaped. Right? You do reap what you sow, but it might take long enough that people who cannot see the forest for the trees can be convinced that it doesn't matter. And as he says, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Folks, we got an entire world today that believes you can ignore the Torah, the instruction of Yah. You can pretend he doesn't exist. You can deny his commandments, his statutes, his judgments. You can deny everything about him. You can deny his rules for economics. And you can think, if I'm the Federal Reserve, we're smarter than God. I remember Alan Greenspan actually said this, folks. The cycle in economics that produces the Great Depression has several names. You'll hear people talk about Elliott Wave Theory, but there was a Russian named Kondratiev. And so his cycle is called the Kondratiev cycle. It's that 70-year or so cycle of depression. And Alan Greenspan famously a few years back, well, not so famously except among the economics crowd, Alan Greenspan said, we will beat the Kondratiev cycle. We're smarter than God. We can beat that thing that he put the Jubilee in place. No, you can't. No, you can't. Because the heart of men is wicked. They don't see the patterns. They think they see the pattern, but they fail to step back far enough from the forest and look and say, you know what, there's another great big wave coming in behind that one. It just may be that the Creator knows a little bit more than you do, in other words, and that his pattern understanding is better than yours. You start thinking you can whack human nature and violate his instruction and create dishonest weights and measures and get away with it, you're going to be gravely disappointed. So what have we seen with the last Kondratiev cycle? The one that Alan Greenspan way back in 2000 was trying to say, we'll eliminate, we'll beat it. Well, they didn't so much as beat it as delay it. And in the meanwhile, what do we got? Well, we got the greatest student debt in history. We've got the greatest accumulated debt, literally, in all of human history. The numbers now of derivatives and debt piled upon debt and contracts upon contracts and dishonest weights and measures compounded is up into the quadrillions. How many zeros is that? Wow. Of dollars. And when it comes down, it'll be cataclysmic. The tree people are still walking through the forest, not noticing that the disease has rooted out not just the part of the forest that they're in, but the entire stinking mess. And there's a forest fire fixing to come and take it all out. You know, we could go nuts with the analogies here, but I think you get the picture, hopefully. And one of the things that I kind of want to address today is this. All right. I disagree, by the way. I think that there are certain things that are national in context. Certainly, my understanding is that the Creator deals with nations. He also dealt with people. And if somebody tells me he doesn't deal with people anymore individually today, I say, well, says who? How are you to know what he said to me? Or how he speaks to me, or in what way? Whether it's through his word or other ways. And I'll suggest, hey, you know, I've actually had things that I know were from him. Is that impossible? Is it outside your experience? Fine. But don't be telling me that I can't, in fact, hear from him and that he can't speak to me individually. But I do understand. There are things that are national in context. Okay, when the judgment befalls, you know, you've heard the stories, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. When people do evil things, we see all of Kings and Chronicles. This king, this other king, they all did evil in the sight of Yah, and then bad things happen. And of course, we know, again, that eventually whole kingdoms, nations, north and south, went into bondage. And we're seeing that pattern repeat. Literally, the big cycles, the Kondratiev cycles, are national cycles. They're international cycles now because of the globalization of the dishonest weights and measures. So it's no surprise that when we see this next particular wave come crashing down, and the fact that the reset lever failed to get pulled, and the debt after 50 years, and then 60, and then 70, and then 80, is compounding and compounding and compounding, and it's fixing to take out everything. Oh, yeah, that's going to be not just a national disaster, that's going to be a worldwide disaster. And I believe there are some things that prophecy has to say about us there, and to us there. And that if we can, in fact, ask, I believe that our Creator will give us answers. Through his word, or individually, or however he chooses to do it. So the question I'm going to ask, we're going to keep coming back to this, is, so what? If the disaster is national, that doesn't mean that I'm any less dead, or bankrupt, or my property is any less taken, or the evil things that happen didn't happen. And yet, you can look back and see, like national disasters, say, in Nazi Germany in the late 1930s and early 40s. There were people who escaped the Holocaust, people who didn't. There were people who escaped from Pol Pot's regime, from Idi Amin's regime, from Soviet Russia, and others who went to the gulags. And there were people who escaped all kinds of disasters throughout history. You know, there's another line from Proverbs. The prudent man sees danger coming. He makes arrangements. He takes precautions. The fool just basically doesn't pay any attention. He doesn't see the pattern. He doesn't see the forest for the trees. Or maybe he sees it. And he thinks he can either beat it, he's better, smarter than God, or he doesn't like what it is that Yah is telling him, and he wants to ignore the instruction or basically shake his fist at him. All kinds of things. Scripture is full of ways that we can mess up, in other words, by not understanding what's happening and by failing to take the proper actions. Essentially, by failing to walk in obedience. But wait, we're not in the land. Well, hey, can we still do the things that he suggests for us to do? Can we still see the patterns? And that's my point. If we can recognize the patterns, I really don't care so much whether we're in the land or not in the land. The only difference is whether things are mandatory or just a darn good idea. And that's the point I want to try to emphasize today. Step back. Hey, if you've got an airplane, if you can use your imagination to soar, to fly, if you can get up above the forest somehow and look down and see the bigger patterns beyond the trees, great. Understand all of those things. Now, I've already mentioned this. There are things that are national, no question. The economic disaster that's coming, the political disaster, a nuclear war, you name it. Lots of those things are national or more in scope. And yet, there are certainly other things that we clearly understand. Arguably, right at the top of the list are things like adultery and idolatry. Hey, let's not kid ourselves. Adultery is an individual act. An individual chooses to commit adultery. And individuals within a nation can choose not to commit idolatry. They can basically flip on the TV and say, okay, I know that I shouldn't be doing this, but hey, you know, everybody else is doing it. It's okay, I'll just go along to get along. And as a matter of fact, that's kind of the standard mode of operation. Because the truth be told, most people don't see the pattern. Because the sentence against that evil work is not executed speedily, they can tell themselves, oh, see, well, didn't collapse today. We didn't get a meltdown today. Hey, haven't you been saying that there was going to be a currency meltdown for a while? Yeah. Hadn't happened yet. Ha ha! I guess I'll just keep doing the same stuff. I can walk in idolatry. I don't have to worry about any of that kind of stuff. I can cheat my brother with dishonest weights and measures. Yeah, I guess I know better, but I can get away with it. I've had people tell me, oh, don't worry, Mark. I'll get out of the system just before it collapses. Right? Like somebody's going to blow a trumpet just before it's too late and say, get out. Now, maybe it will. Maybe if you're smart enough and see the patterns, maybe you can recognize, right? I can tell you when there's an exponential, you sometimes get a little bit of a peak. If it's underdamped, huh, what? Well, suffice it to say, there are all kinds of people that have made lots of money in the stock market by figuring out the patterns and trying to be just a little faster or smarter than the other folks. And when you get to high-frequency trading, what they do is cheat by getting fastest and closest in line so they know what somebody's going to buy a couple of nanoseconds before the trade comes in, and ha ha ha, I can shaft them. I can buy what they want first and sell it to them at a higher price, literally in nanoseconds, and make half a penny per share and do that tens of thousands of times a second. Aren't I clever? Aren't I crooked? Aren't I able to get away with it? It's not a requirement that we watch and obey and do these things necessarily in every case. It's not a requirement that we keep the Shemitah or the Jubilee. It's not a requirement that if we have a farm that we let the land lie fallow or rotate the crops. It will, as a general rule, as it turns out, go better for us. So what do we make of all of that? Well, I'm headed towards this idea of the tree people and the forest people and recognizing the pattern. The pattern is that idolatry and rebellion, both those two things, they never end up doing anything other than bad stuff to those that fall victim to it. Now, this is a good time to continue the cycles for a second and just say, hey, let's take a look at two things. Now, I spent some time on this last night. I'm going to kind of at least touch on it occasionally. The Haftorah portion that goes with today, with the Behar, the Bechukotai, is from Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah. chapters 16 and 17. And this is another one of those places. I really love some of these prophecies where you go read through these books and I just can't help but say, whoa, he's been watching Channel 9 News. He's been checking out CNN. Jeremiah, he knew what was going to, well, of course he did. And he was talking about something that was a lot more immediate in application. He was talking about the fact that, in fact, Israel did go into captivity, did get kicked out of the land. Hey, it's a done deal, Mark. That particular tree's already fallen. Well, is it just possible the cycle could repeat? Is it just possible that the pattern still repeats? What was it that same guy Solomon said? There's nothing new under the sun. What has been is what shall, what has been done is what shall be done. The pattern repeats. Human nature, literally, whether we like it or not, hasn't changed. You got all these world improvers telling you we can make man better. You can be like God. You will not die. Hey, have we heard those lies before? Let me read one line that leaps out at me in Jeremiah 16, then I'll go where I was headed for a second. The word of Yahuwah came to me saying, and it has to do with, again, what's going to happen here. Basically, a big disaster. Verse 10 says, it'll be, O prophet, that when you show the people all of these words, they're going to say the following to you. Why has Yahuwah pronounced all this great disaster against us? What is our iniquity, our Torahlessness? What is our sin that we have committed against Yahuwah Elohim? Today, the same question wouldn't be asked. Today, of course, they deny that he's even allowed in these schools or the halls of Congress or, for crying out loud, the White House or the Oval Office, any place like that. So they could care less about the question. At least the people then seem to have enough wherewithal to ask the question. Well, the answer, he says, you're going to tell them, is because your fathers have forsaken me. Oh, well, that's dad's fault. It's not mine. Well, that's part of the reason why I think this 50-year cycle applies. You know, you got dads and then great-granddads, and the cycle repeats when those that are several generations back are gone and can't pass on their wisdom. But in this case, it's your fathers that have forsaken me, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. They walked after other gods, served them and worshipped them, and have forsaken me and not kept my instruction, my Torah. Uh-oh. And verse 12 says, and you've done worse than your fathers. For behold, each one follows the dictates of his own. Now, it's not just his own heart in this case. It's his own evil heart. So that no one listens to me. Now I pause and say, does that sound familiar? We got a Supreme Court that's fixing to license abomination. Well, at least for those that have signed up, made the deal with the dirty devil, and are following after that particular set of gods. I'm going to suggest to you that's exactly, precisely, one little element, right? Not going to focus on the tree, it's the forest here. The whole forest is stinking rotten. And licensing male-on-male homosexuality and calling it marriage, and that's a slap in the face to his instruction, that's just one of the things. We've got the world reserve currency, right? It's a fake. It's a dishonest measure. It's a dishonest weight. It is called abomination. And we're just getting started. You've done worse than your fathers indeed. For behold, each one follows the dictates of his own evil heart. No one listens to me. Well, no one in the public schools. Pretty well no one in the Congress, certainly no one in the administration or the White House or in the Supreme Court. Therefore, he says, I'll cast you out of this land into a land you do not know. There you'll serve other gods day and night. I won't show you any favor. Oh, see, there you go. It's all done. That happened, Mark. It's over. Let me say it again. Is it just possible that the pattern can repeat? Is it just possible that even if we're already in exile, and we're already kicked out of the land, and we're still doing all the basically nasty stuff that, because we've still continued to serve those other gods night and day, is it just possible it could get, I don't know, seven times worse? Therein comes the pattern again. Now, there's another word I need to throw into the mix here. Some of you may have heard this. Not just patterns and repeating patterns and cycles of cycles, Ezekiel's comment, wheels within wheels. There's also the something you'll see, this is a cool terminology, fractals. You know what a fractal is? A fractal is a repeating pattern, and there's all kinds of pretty pictures, and probably the example that most people that aren't mathematicians or that haven't seen Mandelbrot's work at IBM or any of that kind of stuff would refer to are, things like tree leaves. I've seen some great artwork. There's little leaves on a tree, and if you zoom in, you see a little pattern. And in the leaf are little teeny patterns that look like leaves, and you zoom in on those, and you can keep zooming in or zooming out, and the same pattern repeats on a macro scale. It's fascinating. But it's a similar kind of a concept. And what as an engineer really strikes me about all of this is it's the way that our Creator, in His brilliance, in the absolute incredible nature of His design, has taken certain equations and certain properties and certain characteristics. You could call them laws, right? Like the law of gravity and the various other laws of thermodynamics and physics. And they fit together, and out of the math come certain repeating patterns. And the same thing is true of human nature. And it's indeed part of the reason why this Torah is so instructive to us, and why I will suggest that in the land or not, basically, we certainly continue to share certain things. Solomon, again, had it right. There's nothing new under the sun. We're the same people, whether we're in the land or out. Now, the difference is, of course, that those in the land had better education than we do. And they probably, because Yah said in this portion, he said, I will walk among you. Hey, that's a pretty wonderful promise. I will walk among you. You'll dwell in your land safely. I'll walk among you, says verse 12, chapter 26, and be your Elohim, and you shall be my people. Well, clearly that's different. But it doesn't necessarily mean the human nature changed. It just means they had a better education system, and they weren't in debt up to their elbows to have to pay for something that they were going to have to unlearn later in order to come back into obedience to the Creator. All right, I want to go back to the 7 times 7 again and just mention a couple things there, because this is where we're going to branch off and then talk about where we are today. And again, most importantly, what it is that... And probably some of the what it is not going to surprise you. But what it is that we need to do. So, somewhere we see these patterns repeat. By the way, we're going to see these similar patterns repeat in Scripture too, because in Deuteronomy, end of the book, close to the end of the Torah, we're going to see chapter 28 and 29, 30 of the place where he says, here you go. Here's a bunch of blessings if you will follow me, and here's a bunch of curses if you don't. And the pattern is similar there too. There are more curses than blessings. Maybe that's because, if you've ever noticed, little kids oftentimes learn a lot from pain. The example that I've used many, many times, the child wants to put his hand on the stove. Why can't I touch the stove? It'll burn you. I want to touch the stove. It's going to burn you. I want to touch the stove. Well, eventually, maybe the wise parent, just knowing the child, says, all right, go for it. Why didn't you tell me? I did. Why wouldn't you listen? Well, I needed 7 times more pain in order to finally get it through my thick head that when Daddy says or Mommy says, don't touch that, they were not kidding. So chapter 26 says, you're not to make any idols, okay, nor bow down to them. Keep my Sabbaths, reverence my sanctuary. And then he says, if you will walk in my statutes and keep my commandments, there are those words again, I'll give you all this good stuff, rains in the season, there'll be yield of your trees and your fields, and you will dwell in your land safely. You'll have peace in the land. Any enemies that will come up against you, well, they will fall by a sword that probably might even be friendly fire, observes Rashi. Sounds like a pretty good stuff. And, of course, the crowning of this, verse 12, I will walk among you, be your Elohim, and you shall be my people. But, you knew it was coming, right? But, if you will not hearken to me and will not do all of these mitzvot, and if you reject my ordinances, mishpati, and my commandments, mitzvoti, and break my covenant, briti, then here's what I'm going to do to you. Now, see if this sounds familiar. I will appoint terror over you. I'll appoint terror over you. Do I even have to say it? What is the entire modus operandi of Big Brother worldwide today? I got a t-shirt somebody gave me a long time ago. It says, UN, peace through terror. In other words, the biggest brother you can imagine is probably arguably the biggest terrorist, and he uses terror as a threat to control those people that want to see him, Big Brother, as a god. So there we are. I'll appoint terror over you, and consumption and fever. maybe even bioengineered diseases. Your eyes will fail, soul languish, sow your seed in vain, and your enemies will eat it. And I'll set my face against you, and you'll be smitten before your enemies. And get this, this ought to kind of ring true. Those that hate you shall rule over you. They hint, they don't just hate you or me. They hate especially the God that we serve. And they hate the fact that we don't serve their God. No question. I don't think you can possibly deny, oh, we're not in the land. This has already happened, Mark. Yeah, and guess what? It's happening again. Can't you see the pattern? For crying out loud, those that hate you shall rule over you. You'll flee when none pursues you. If you don't yet, for all of those things, hearken unto me, well, then I'm going to keep chastening you. Those he loves, he chastens, like a parent chastens a child, right? Proverbs. All right, going to get seven times worse. And as I've already mentioned, it gets seven times seven worse, and then it gets seven times worse. I'll smite you, bring a sword upon you, execute the vengeance of the covenant. You'll be gathered together within your cities. You'll be piled into cesspools like New York and Chicago, I think is the implication here. I'll send pestilence among you. You'll be delivered into the hands of the enemies. All right, you know it. So at this point, I have to ask the question. We still got one more set of seven to go before we finish with chapter 26's summary here. Where are we in this sequence, right? I think it's pretty clear. Chapter 26 says it starts out with seven times, and your enemies, they that hate you, shall rule over you. Okay, check. We're at least into that. Then are we a seven times more? You can go through some of these things and just ask yourself these questions. This is a good thought experiment. How many more sevens do we have to go? You know, think about what happens in an economic meltdown. I've got one story I'm going to do out of sequence here. I'll mention it now. There's a company called Deagle. The question is, who are they and what the heck are they? They're some kind of a think tank. They seem to have something to do with military contracts. Are they accurate or not? Well, it's hard to say. But one thing that is hard to argue with, at least, they have actually produced a report, and they have made the claim that 78% of the U.S. population, and indeed similar amounts, vast majorities, more than half, of all of the Western world's populace is going to be dead in a decade or so. What? Yeah. More than, well, in the United States, they're saying 78% of the population will either leave the country, try to escape, or be dead in the late teens and by the early 20s anyway. Massive depopulation and collapse. Is it legitimate or not? Well, most people that at least see the predictions and understand what, for example, the military has said following an EMP event or a grid down event or a terror event that takes down the power grid, vast majorities of the population, the vast majority, four-fifths or so, would be dead within a year. The former, evil minion in charge of the DHS, Janet Napolitano, made the claim as she was leaving that there will be, she didn't say might happen, she said will be, a power grid failure in the United States. Maybe the thing to do is think about getting off the power grid, come out of her on that score. Will be. Now, are they false prophets? Again, I don't know. I think there's a prudent thing. A prudent man sees danger coming and takes action. Certainly it's prudent, too, to start looking at patterns and recognizing that there are things that if we've seen the pattern happen over and over again, just like the little girl sees the pattern with the jump rope, you can time your entry and exit, if nothing else. And you know what? Better to be, the old saying on Wall Street, better to be a year early than a day late. We're already in exile. But that still doesn't mean that there aren't things that we can do. I'm not a fatalist. I don't like the attitude that, well, you know, if this is a national disaster that's coming and 80% of the people are going to die, I guess it's just I'm dead, right? Oh, maybe Scotty will beam me up. Maybe there'll be a rapture and I'll be beamed out of here. Well, you know, read more carefully. I'm going to go back to the solution thing, and we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the elements of what's going on in the news. So what do you do? right? If there's a national disaster coming, answer. Remember that certain things are individual acts. I can still choose to walk in obedience to Elohim as best I can as an individual. I can certainly begin to turn from idolatry, from adultery. I can just say, I'm not going to commit adultery in that scale, in that sense. In a physical sense or in a spiritual sense. Are we spiritualizing it? Well, maybe. I'll go one step further. I think that there's a line, and I know some people don't like it because it's from the Brit Hadashah, but a line from Shaul about speaking the truth boldly as we ought to speak it. Hey, I think that's pretty darn good midrash. It's good advice. There's a time to shut up, and there's a time for everything, right? There's a time to speak the truth boldly as we ought to speak it. We know that Ezekiel says if you've been appointed as a watchman on the wall and there's a sword coming upon the land, you keep your mouth shut, and the blood of those people who perish, I'll require at your hand, says Yah. First, and look down and say, look, there's a great big forest fire coming and you better get the hell out of here before you burn alive. I suggest that there is a duty. And by the way, we just had this in a recent Torah portion. There's a duty to inform your brother. There's a duty. A duty. And I think it applies wherever we are, to do certain things. If you see some bad that's going to happen to his property, well, if there's something you can do about it, try to stop it. And I think that the things that we're seeing having to do with the depopulation agenda, we know for sure, they're literally our people, not just who don't see the connection, you know, but their heart is fully set in them to do wickedness and to do evil. Human heart is desperately wicked. That, by the way, is from this this Haftorah portion tonight. 17. Where is it? 16:19? Yep. Surely our fathers have inherited lies, worthlessness, and unprofitable things. Will a man make gods for himself which are not gods? Oh, there's that one. And then there's the other one about... the heart is deceitful above all things. That's chapter 17 here, same Torah, Haftorah portion. The heart is deceitful above all things, said Yirmiyahu, and desperately wicked. Who can know it? There are people that are just simply planning to do evil things. They're more than willing to kill, to steal, to use dishonest weights and measures, to consolidate power, and they're more than willing to be convinced that 80-90 more percent of the population of the earth needs to die. So they'll have a little bit more elbow room. And they can fly their corporate jets and tell you that you can't have an SUV with impunity. So let's talk about a little of the news. I want to just start with a couple of these things, and I'm going to keep going back to Yirmiyahu and keep going back to this idea of the 7 times 7 and just asking some rhetorical questions. Where are we? We're in exile. How many sevens down the line are we? How much worse, if it gets 7 times worse from here, how much worse will that be? Can it get 7 times worse from that? Oh, yeah. Well, we're not seeing mass starvation yet in most of the Western world. Certainly we are in other places. We haven't yet seen nuclear war. That would at least be 7 times worse. This week we had yet another false flag. Was it a false flag or was it just stupid people supposedly protecting you from terror who are utterly and totally incompetent? Well, in Texas, at a place called Garland, some are pointing out this is a Gladio-style operation. Operation Gladio was literally another one of these false flag things that you can go back and look at history and say, yep, that sounds a lot like what we're seeing. And it goes something like this. Even some of the major three-letter news agencies are confirming that the so-called bad guys, the ISIS, that's the latest terminology for them, these are the people that the borders are open so that they can come across if they want to. And while we're being told, be afraid, be very afraid of ISIS, no, that's not the real issue. Really, we've got Jade Helm and we've got all kinds of other things. The FBI's for years been saying, no, no, no. It's those people with pocket constitutions and Bibles. The sovereign citizens, the domestic terrorists, the lone wolves that are the real threat. That's how come they watch and listen. Big Brother watches and listens to everybody because you are the real terrorists. Forget these ISIS guys. We do. Turns out that despite the chatter among groups online, at least one, and then it came out, no, it looks like both of the suspects that were shot, not by the SWAT team that was standing by right there, SWAT team was right there. No, it was a, I guess it was an off-duty cop saw the security guard get shot and finally said, ain't nobody else going to do anything, I better kill these folks. And he did. Made two good shots or more and put both of the bad guys down. Uh-oh, that wasn't supposed to happen, maybe. In any case, they had been under FBI surveillance since at least 2007. What is that, 7 full years? Hey, a full speed of cycle. They were watching these so-called terrorists and doing what? Nothing. Other than just letting them go ahead and do what they want. Why are we surprised? But isn't it a great excuse for saying, well, we need more of the hair of the dog? We need 7 times more of the evil stuff that we're doing already that doesn't matter. I go next to this piece. This is from John Whitehead. I like John. He's president of the Rutherford Institute, writes on a lot of libertarian topics, and I usually see him in lewrockwell.com. He said, when you have a cop culture, a police state, the Bill of Rights doesn't amount to squat. He said this, if you can be kicked, punched, tasered, shot, intimidated, harassed, stripped, searched, brutalized, terrorized, wrongfully arrested, and, of course, even killed by a police officer, and that so-called officer is never held accountable for violating what, ha-ha, you thought were your rights, you don't have any, hint, hint, and his oath of office, too, didn't he promise to protect and serve and uphold the Constitution of the state in which he is in and the, well, Union of States, it doesn't matter anymore, you know, all of that stuff. Why doesn't it matter? Well, if you've been paying attention, we've talked about this. It's clear. But nevertheless, he violates all of those things, doesn't serve and protect, and he's never forced to make amends, never told that what he did was wrong, never even given much of a slap on the wrist, and never made to change his modus operandi. Well, you can claim that you live in a lot of places, but one of them sure as heck ain't a constitutional republic. Police state is probably a better way to put it. What matters nowadays, he says, if you're living in most of the Western world, is to understand, will you make it through a police confrontation alive? For a growing number of Americans in particular, those things don't end well. The Dallas police chief, David O. Brown, said not long ago, it seems sometimes like our young officers want to get into an athletic event with people they want to arrest. They have a don't retreat mentality. Hey, it's kind of like Jade Helm. You fight the way you have been trained. If you're trained that the enemy are a ma and pa shop in southern Texas that you need to infiltrate, as opposed to, say, I don't know, something in Afghanistan where they speak a different language than Texas drawl, who is it that you're being trained to fight? Who are you being conditioned, whether you know it or not, to see as the enemy? Answer, isn't it obvious? Even if you are stuck in the forest and can't see anything but trees? That one ought to be clear, I would hope. I won't go through all of Whitehead's story. It's a pretty good, interesting article here. But he says, basically, here's part of the key to understanding it. It's funny, in other words. There's a Bill of Rights, was actually put in genuine print. It doesn't have squat to do anymore with the way the world works, right? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Well, they do. Or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, they do. Or prohibiting the freedom of speech or assembly, yeah, well, we've got net neutrality now. Second Amendment shall not be infringed, hardly. Tens of thousands of infringements in most big cities, Chicago, New York, L.A., unless you're an evil bad guy who doesn't care, or an evil bad guy who's got a badge and a gun, you can't have a weapon. Well, unless, of course, if you know the machine mob boss mayor, Rahm Emanuel, personal, buy lunch for Rahm and maybe you'll get a permit. In any case, he points this out. This is an investigative journalist that wrote the story. The rights that are almost always universally afforded to police officers accused of wrongdoing, it was in the Huffington Post, include the following. I'm not going to read this whole list because it's exhaustive. There's a lot more to it here than your mere Bill of Rights about, you know, no illegal search and seizure and no groping you without a warrant or taking your stuff without a warrant and probable cause, particularly naming what it is that they're going to take, or prohibiting you from having firearms, or requiring that you get due process. No, none of that stuff anymore. Says this, though. When it comes to a police officer, if the department decides to pursue a complaint, the department must notify the officer and, of course, his union. Excuse me. And he actually, get this, he has to know about the testimony to be offered against him before he is questioned. Nowadays, right, if you've seen the NDAA and so forth, you can be killed. And they don't even have to have evidence. Used to be you had a right to face your accuser. and to see the evidence. No, none of that stuff applies. Better be a cop. During questioning, the investigators may not harass, threaten, or promise rewards to the officers. Contrast that with what happens to the peons. Bathroom breaks are mandated during questioning. And then in some jurisdictions, the officer may not be disciplined if more than a certain number of days have passed. Usually it's 100 since the alleged misconduct. So the investigation better happen fast or it's not going to happen at all. And finally, if the officer is suspended in almost every case, the department continues to pay salary and benefits as well as the cost of the officer's attorney. So there you go. It's a pretty sweet deal if you can get it, says Whitehead. I guess when you have all these things added up, protection from the courts, immunity from wrongdoing, you're paid while you're under investigation, and you have assurance that you won't have to spend a dime of your own money, and you're going to get better than a public defender, you can rest assured. And all of that, he suggests, is a problem, and it's at least at part of the root of what's wrong today. Now, I'm going to say, you know, we've talked about this in the last couple of days. There is one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you, according to Torah. Oh, that's only in the land too. Well, maybe so. I'll tell you what, sure as hell doesn't apply in virtually any place in the Western world today. You know, the idea of the Bill of Rights was, at least at one time, it was a beacon, right? A shining city on a hill for the rest of the world to see and to emulate. I guarantee you they're not emulating it, and the U.S. doesn't even pay lip service to it anymore. I've got this quick story. Now, this is funny, and I'm going to just go quickly through it. The Second Circus has issued a scathing condemnation. No, hardly. They basically said that the NSA phone wiretap program, that they basically took the Unconstitutional Patriot Act, and the Patriot Act, of course, was supposed to protect you explicitly from terrorists, and they basically extended it to anything they want, using it in routine investigations, having to do with things like money laundering and drug dealing. And, of course, if a cop suspects his wife is cheating on him, that's okay, too. We'll wiretap those phones. All of that, says the Second Circus, bad, bad boys. You went beyond the intent of Congress. You exceeded constitutional... Very bad misstep. You exceeded congressional authority. Such expansive development of government repositories of formerly private records, the court wrote, would be an unprecedented contraction of the privacy expectations of all Americans. what a laugh. This guy obviously hasn't ever been into an airport and had his gonads groped. No, he's probably just gone into the little booth like an obedient judge and raised his arms and said, yeah, check out what I got under here. Anyway, or maybe he was given an exemption. Who knows? Anyway, yeah, says the court, national security is probably a perfectly good justification for this rape of the Bill of Rights. But when you go beyond the statutory problems, things that are listed there, now we're going to have to not even slap you on the wrist. What did they do? They basically just said, this is not good. But they failed to issue an injunction, and they failed to say that it needs to be fixed. And for crying out loud, more importantly, they failed to even point out that everything that happened in the law itself was a complete violation of the Fourth Amendment. Now, we're not surprised by this. I can give you all kinds of perfectly logical rationalizations, and that's literally what they are, as to why it is that the law doesn't apply anymore. My point is just simply step back, take a look from a couple thousand feet above the forest, and see just how bad things are. The forest is rotting, and if there's not a fire yet, it's primed and ready for it. Chicago, another place where you can see just how rotten the forest is, has approved reparations for police torture victims. Yeah, 40 years later, after lots and lots and lots of people were tortured. Hey, isn't that supposed to be against the law? Well, they got caught. They've approved reparations. They're going to pay $5.5 million. And if you're still alive, isn't that wonderful for you? Rahm Emanuel, the crooked machine mayor of one of the most dishonest cities in the entire world, said, we were wrong, and we are finally coming to terms with it. No, you're not. You got caught. And it took decades and decades, and you're still denying the lesson. The lesson is called the Bill of Rights. And you're not just raping the torture victims, okay? Most Chicagoans don't have access to hardly any of those things in the Bill of Rights. They simply don't apply to the peons in Chi-Town. There's a story in here about the former Chicago police commander who basically committed perjury upon perjury upon perjury, lying about police torture and testimony that he gave in solemn testimony civil lawsuits. Hey, you know, what can you say other than what's a little bit of perjury if you're covering up treason? And the article then finally concludes by saying, oh, really, this is all about race. No, it's not. There were a lot of people that were black that were tortured. And you know what, folks? I don't care what people, what color people are. We shouldn't be torturing any of them, not you nor the stranger that dwells among you. That's why the concept of justice being blind, ha-ha, is such a laugh anymore. That was the whole point of one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. No matter what color he is or anything else. It's why the whole idea that the Bill of Rights only applies to citizens is another fallacy. The ones that literally are finding out that it doesn't apply are the ones that by agreement have entered into that deal with the devil. Which takes me back again to the theme that I'm going to continue to emphasize. What do we do? Adultery, idolatry are individual acts. So is coming out of her. Does that mean that there aren't national things that will happen? Does that mean that Big Brother isn't going to still try to take those that are in exile, that are under his thumb, and squeeze and do everything possible to coerce and kill them if necessary in order to make them fit? Yeah. Do we have firm, ironclad promises? Well, we have some promises in Scripture. If you'll walk in obedience, there'll be blessings. Does that mean we're not going to die? No, I'm not going to try to claim that it does. Does that mean that we're not going to see bad things happen to our children or ourselves or our loved ones? No, sadly it doesn't. But I guarantee you, if you walk in ignorance and in rebellion, even if it takes a while, even if the lag is a long time, if your heart is desperately set to do wickedness, well, eventually the comeuppance will happen. All right, we also had some other things happening this week just to kind of show us where we are in the 7x7 cycle. I like this idea of the Yovel and the fact that, hey, we're well past when the reset lever should have been pulled. The debt now is literally completely, utterly out of control. We're seeing the pigs nations, Greece. There was more news on Greece. Not going to go into all that. The laws have now been changed to the point where in most of the world, what are called bail-ins are imminently on the horizon. Negative interest rates are in place, too. In other words, the banksters are beginning to charge people for the privilege of keeping what they thought was their money in a place where literally it's nothing more than an unsecured loan to the banksters to keep on defrauding others. And here's the real kicker, folks. They're going to charge you. That's what negative interest rates are. They charge. You put in $10,000, you get back $9,900. Or if you leave it in longer, you get back $9,000. Or hey, nowadays, because what they're doing in Greece is saying, we're going to charge you to try to make a withdrawal. You're going to get $9,900 minus our extra fees, too. And if you don't like that, if you don't take it out, well, we may just take it all. That's what the bail-in is about. Oh, when we go bankrupt, well, you're an unsecured creditor. Stand in line. Maybe you'll get 20 cents on the dollar back. Well, this week in the United States, we had the Bureau of Lying Statistics came out. And I'll just do this one quickly. This is a piece from Dave Kranzler. I like the way he puts it in his headline. There's no BS like the BLS. Speaking of BS, CNBC, one of the tout TV networks, the financial talking heads, claimed that the jobs report was just wonderful, and they called it Goldilocks. How's that for a lie? Goldilocks, right? Not too hot, not too cold. It's just right. It's good enough that there's growth, and we can lie to you and pretend that we believe that. Oh, but it's not enough that we're going to have to raise rates. So the vapor taper is still on. Now, here's the funny part that the press is not making very much of at all. There's something called the birth-death model, which is basically they just make up jobs. They've been doing this for years. I've talked about it for years, too. They'll say, well, we don't know for sure. We have no idea how many real jobs were added, but we know what we want the final number to come out to be, so we have this fudge factor we're going to add in. We're going to assume that people are born and people die, and jobs are born and jobs are dying. How much do we need this month? Oh, I know. Ready? Out of the 223,000 jobs that the Bureau of Lying Statistics claims were added by the miraculously Goldilocks economy in April, 213,000 of those, 96%, were fairy tale. They were, as this guy puts it, BLS BS. They were made up out of whole cloth. And not only that, Don Pardo, tell them what else they've won. March, which was hideously bad, but hey, it's the headlines that matter. Nobody ever goes back, especially not to computer algorithms, and looks at last month's headlines. March was revised lower from an already pitiful 126,000 jobs to a horrific 85K. So what are we seeing? In other words, this is all standard operating procedure, SOP. Just keep lying to people, make the headline look good, and then when nobody's looking, and we're already planning on doing this, we'll revise the numbers next month. Will the central banks abolish cash? You betcha. That's kind of where I've been leading. A lot of this is all about trapping people in the national context, telling you, hey, you can't possibly survive without cash. Now, I believe, you don't have to believe likewise, that there's a pretty darn good prophecy. As a matter of fact, it's one of those things that kind of helped me back in my paganistic days of not believing Yah at all to return and begin to study His Word. Was this idea comes from the book of Revelation, which in fact is a prophecy that literally, for the most part, is, as some will point out, plagiarism. In other words, it's more like a second or a third witness to other things you can see in places like Daniel and even in books like Joshua, talking about the first time into the land. In other words, the patterns are there and they repeat. That's part of the reason why I look at the pattern in Revelation and I look at the patterns in society and say, hey, when it says that there'll come this time when no one will buy or sell without being coerced to take some kind of a mark, I think, come on, who's kidding who? I don't know if it's a perfect translation because I don't think we have the original Hebrew, but I guarantee you, I can see all of the elements of that are already in place. The pattern is there. They're doing nothing except executing on it. And the war on cash, and the negative interest rates, and the coming collapse of the economy that'll be used to say, oh, see, we got to have a new system rising like a phoenix out of the ashes of the old. You can see how the pattern's going to play. And you can literally do everything except dates. Do I know precisely how long this house of cards will stay up before a tiny gust of wind or a passing butterfly knocks it down? No. If I had to bet, I'd say, like a lot of those do, that, you know, there's a pattern that seems to kind of repeat around September, October. Great crashes. Maybe it'll happen again. Can't argue with that. If it was me, I'd say better a year early than a day late. I would want to have certain preparations in place. Something real. I'd want to be out of certain places. I'd want to be in safer places long before, well, let's just say the fall feasts of this year. Am I making a prediction? No. Am I just saying I can see the pattern and having been there and done that and seen what's gone on before that it seems like a prudent thing to do to take the precautions? You betcha. And I also guarantee you that the war on cash is real. And it's obvious. And that already, look at when, you know, the suspicious activity reports in the United States. They're doing everything they can, and indeed the whole world, to prevent people from being able to legally move cash internationally, hold on to cash, pay for things with cash. I talked last week about, you know, all over Europe, what's going on and how it's being done. No surprises. Those, you know, forewarned is forearmed. Get your assets out of the banks, says one of the pieces I'm looking at here. It's only a matter of time before THSTF. Okay. Let me talk about one or two other things, and we'll start to wrap it up. Any questions or comments, put those on the screen. Is it good to mention a couple of more things from Yirmiyahu at this point? This chapter 16 and chapter 17 thing essentially starts, and as so many places where Yirmiyahu does and Ezekiel does, points out that it's not just the northern kingdom, Israel, not just the southern kingdom, Judah, but both that are in a whole world of hurt. Chapter 17 begins by saying, after talking about Israel mostly in chapter 16, the sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron. It's engraved with the point of a diamond on the tablet of their heart. All these bad things. Talking again about children and their images and their idols and their green trees in the hill. And he says, this sounds familiar too, I'm going to cause you to serve your enemies in a land which you do not know. Check. And then it says this. This is what really catches my eye and what I want to mention out of this chapter here. Cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart departs from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, he will be like a shrub in the desert. He'll not see it when good comes, but he'll inhabit instead the parched places in the wilderness, in a salt land not inhabited. Does it seem to you folks, I'm just going to ask it, it certainly does to me, no surprise there, it seems like when you look at the world today, we got an entire world that's built on men trusting in man. We can license abomination, whether it's something that we're going to call marriage or whether it's something that we're going to call money. We'll license it. We can print it. If you print it, we'll call it counterfeiting and you go to jail. Okay? Pick your abomination. We're licensing it and encouraging it and mandating it and subsidizing it and penalizing those who don't want to play, especially if they don't know enough to come out completely in advance and in the right way. Trust in man makes strength his armament, makes flesh his arm, his strength. Yeah. Again, look at the police state. Look at the security terror state. Look at the airports. This is not hard. But blessed, says verse 7, is the man who trusts in Yahuwah and whose hope is Yahuwah. He is like the tree planted by the waters. We've heard this verse. Spreading out its roots by the river and will not fear when heat comes. His leaf will be green. Uh-oh, there's another metaphor. Are we saying that men are like trees? Yeah, that's what simile is. It says like a tree. Can we learn something from that? Clearly men are not trees. No, but we can in fact see the point here, right? We can take the instruction. And then it says in verse 9, this one we've talked about too, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, Yahuwah, search the heart. I test the mind to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruits of his doings. Now, does this apply in the land? Or is it wherever we may be happening to be? Is this a national thing? Or is it an individual promise? You know what, folks? I recognize that sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes we can be disappointed. Yeah, sometimes, and I can't tell you how many times, I know everybody listening has heard this, oh, I did the right thing and I was, still bad things happened. My loved one was killed. My son was taken. My wife was taken. All this bad stuff happened. I blame God. Well, you know what? It's one of the oldest topics you'll find book after book if you go to a Christian bookstore or just about any library. Why do bad things happen to good people? And by the way, what's a good person, right? How do you know? Is their heart wicked? I don't know the answers to those questions, neither do most of us. I know this. I would rather trust in His Word. When he says things like, I, Yahuwah, search the heart, I trust the mind, to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. I would rather do that than to make flesh my strength and to trust in man. Because I already know where that leads. I can take a look. I can see that particular pattern. Ain't nothing new under the sun. There's a line here towards the end of this. Yirmiyahu prays for deliverance. Heal me, O Yahuwah, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved, for you are my praise. Interesting and appropriate prayer. And then it talks about the Sabbath day. Take heed to yourselves. Bear no burden on the Sabbath, says the prophet, speaking for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Don't carry a burden. They fail to set it apart, as I commanded your fathers. They didn't obey me, says verse 23. This is where we'll wrap up this part of it. They didn't obey, nor did they incline their ear, but they instead made their neck stiff that they might not hear nor receive instruction. Okay. Let me talk about one or two more other items in the news. This is a headline story from a news magazine that World Net Daily puts out called The Whistleblower. And their headline this month is something they call Faith Crimes. Now, there's a lot of irony in this, so I'm just going to kind of mention it. I think most of the irony will be clear. Excuse me. The subtitle is, and it tells the whole story, they say, How Courageous Christians Practicing Their Religion Are Being Persecuted in Obama's America. Let me say that again. How courageous Christians practicing their religion are being persecuted in Obama's America. Unquote. Now, I'm not going to give answers. I'm just going to ask questions. Are these 501c3 state-licensed, Caesar-created, and chartered faith-based institutions that, whether they know it or not, are literally beholden to some god that makes demands and has given them a corporate charter and is, in fact, if they'll read the fine print, their creator? Could that have anything to do with the legal prohibition that the next line talks about? Legally prohibiting the free exercise of religion in America? Well, hey, the oldest saying that I can think of on the subject is, if you take the king's money, you better play the king's tune. Are you getting your exemption? Have you looked up what an exemption is in a law dictionary? It's permission from the Creator, if you want to think of it that way, to be exempt from His requirements. Well, what He giveth, He can take away. Who is the master here? Interestingly, a lot of those same Christians will have a little fish symbol on their car and not recognize that what's going on in America is literally, in some ways, legally backwards. And there's a lot to be said about that, right? Think about cycles. You note that every half cycle, the system inverts. Right? The cycle goes positive, then it goes negative, and it goes back to zero, goes positive, then goes back to zero, goes negative again. The cycle has a high point and a low point, and points where it literally reverses direction. Think of a pendulum. Well, think of Rome and ask yourself the question, and I saw a story this week that really upset me. It was some guy telling us, oh, there's so many things people don't know about the ancient world that they get wrong. And then he went on to proclaim some lies about Rome and how, oh, Christians say they were only once persecuted in Rome up until Constantine. Oh, no, no, there were other groups that were persecuted in Rome too. Well, excuse me, big deal. He misses the whole point. Rome licensed various organizations. And if you could get a license, you could have public meetings. The early Christians basically refused to take a corporate structure in place. Call it licensing, call it a corporate. It was the essentially Roman equivalent of the 501c3. Was it tax exempt? Not that is a matter. The point is, you wanted to meet in public, you essentially would go and get permission, and that was fine. The only string attached was you just had to worship Caesar occasionally. Plenty of other gods out here in Rome. We're fine with that Yahuwah person you want to talk about, or that Yahushua person you want to talk about, and that's all fine. Just get your license, and, you know, once a year, however long, however often we say, then you pay a little bit of worship to Caesar too. Plenty of gods around, and they didn't like that. Serve Yod Heh Vav Heh and Him alone. Other gods was a problem. Well, where are we at in the United States today? This is why I say it's the opposite part of the cycle. Interestingly enough, if you read the First Amendment carefully, it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Hey, but can we create an organization? And can we create various kinds of laws that you can volunteer into by agreement? And then we'll give you special bennies if you take the king's money? And in exchange for that, you'll owe us a few little, you know, fealties every now and then. Sure. You can sign up for that deal. Are we then prohibiting the free exercise of religion? No, no. That worship of the creator, Yod Heh Vav Heh, has nothing to do with the official state worship that's coming out of Washington. Completely outside of its jurisdiction. So what's funny about this is, we got a lot of people now that they're being persecuted for their religion in Obama's America, without recognizing why, that they made the deal with the devil, and now they're simply reaping what they sow. Hey, what was it that guy Solomon said? Because the consequences of an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the hearts of the sons of men are fully set in them to do evil. In other words, hey, you know, you get a corporate license to be a licensed denomination or a licensed church, it might take decades. Indeed, it did. This dates all the way back to the New Deal era, and then Lyndon Baines Johnson. Oh, think of it, folks. About a human lifespan or so before the wickedness became fully mature and the evil fruit was ready to be harvested. this shouldn't surprise us. Gonna kind of skip over this story. There was an interesting piece came out of Judge Andrew P. Napolitano, former federal judge this week, called Restore the Fourth. He says it's making an appearance on college campuses. Restore the Fourth is a reference to the Fourth Amendment. And they're basically pushing for, somebody to actually pay attention to the fact that there once upon a time was a Bill of Rights. And he points out that in the dark days after 9/11, Congress passed, I'm going to say it, the evil, utterly unconstitutional Rape the Bill of Rights Patriot Act. And it had many flaws, says Judge Napolitano, but it included the prohibition of certain truthful public speech. Yeah, so there were a lot of things wrong with it, but arguably its most pernicious assault was on the once constitutional right to privacy. He talks about general warrants and basically says, you know, that was what got the colonists so upset. It's why the Fourth Amendment was written, and that's exactly what the Patriot Act is doing, is the same thing that the evil King George was doing. The idea was to prohibit government fishing additions, common in totalitarian countries, and now common in this totalitarian country. So, here's the key, and I mentioned this just because I think it's interesting. So watch. Watch and learn. You're not going to hear much about this, I don't think, except up until maybe the last few days before the end of May, then there'll be some posturing and positioning and some lying going on. The section of the Patriot Act, says Napolitano, that is constitutionally the most offensive is set to expire on May 31st. The emperor, of course, wants it extended. So do the birds flapping in unison in the R wing of the bird of prey. Republican leadership agrees. They accept the myth, right, let's trade a little essential liberty for temporary security. So they're basically going along to get along. Flap, flap, flap. Watch and see what happens on May 31st. This second circus was a good indication, all right? The court comes out and gets a few little headlines saying, oh, we told the NSA, bad, bad, bad NSA. And they didn't even so much as slap them on the wrist. They just printed a little stuff that said, basically, we're not going to do anything about it. Keep on doing it. By the way, there was a story that I didn't print out this morning from Hillary Clinton. Remember the big scandal about how I'm above the law. You can't tap my phone and my emails because I'm going to disobey the law as Secretary of State and not even put my stuff on the state secure government server. No, I'm going to get it out there and I'm going to get all these donations for the Bill and Hillary Clinton Foundation and all that kind of stuff. Well, the State Department spokesman came out basically within the last 24 hours and said, no harm, no foul. Not gonna bother to investigate that. Watch and learn. Watch and learn. One law for you and the terrorist that dwells among you. Now the terrorists can go free. But you guys, on the other hand, do you have a license from the state? Now we're talking. So watch and learn. See what happens in the end of May. And finally, there's this one. And I mentioned this, too, because we're not surprised, but we'll close with this one. Is it your car? Not so much. A fellow named Eric Peters that writes on car title subjects and liberty-oriented things having to do with cars printed this piece about the government wants to control your car. Now, I've noticed for a long time and made observations having to do with title and color of title and manufacturer's certificate of origin and lots of technical stuff. And basically, what's happened is this. For a long, long time, a car is not a car. It is an automobile. And you don't drive a car. You operate a motor vehicle. And what sounds like trivial distinctions are, in fact, the kind of clever ways that lawyers manage to rookie-doo you into a system and get you to do all kinds of silly things, like essentially trading a right to travel in exchange for a privilege to operate a motor vehicle, licensed, of course, on the public thoroughfares. And it turns out that, at least originally, all of that was a commercial activity. The only thing that could be licensed was, hey, does this sound familiar? Buying or selling. How clever they are. And it turns out that if you actually will study in almost every state, every single state that I'm aware of, what happens is the manufacturer's certificate of origin is the thing that identifies the owner of the motor vehicle. And when you go buy a new car, what you do is trade that, entering into a legal contract, trade that away to the almighty state, and in exchange you get a permission slip a permit to use it. And they'll put something on your car. They give you a license and all kind of other stuff. But guess who owns the car? Yeah. It's pretty well obvious, isn't it? And here's Eric Peters saying, that's not enough. It's not enough that that they already own it in a legal sense. They're going to own it in a technical sense, too. So already, government wants to control how your car is made, what it comes equipped with, and how, of course, you're allowed to drive it. But here's the other half of the pinchers. They want to prevent you from even being able to work on what you thought was your car. Even routine maintenance is now going to become illegal via application and enforcement of something called the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And you can skip over all the legalese, but basically, just like with computers, we own the software, we own the car. If you touch it, you're a criminal. And now, we gotcha. And, I mean, look at places like in Costa Rica, where even old cars, incredibly well-controlled, and they try to keep them running for a long, long time because Big Brother watches it all. Well, in the United States and in the places that are a little bit further up the curve, what they want to do is they want to be able to tax people by the mile. They want to get all the older cars off the road, and they want to be able to say, we need complete and total control. So here's just another way of making sure all of that is going to happen. Shouldn't surprise anybody, and we could literally talk for a long time about it. I like the conclusion that Peters gives. He says, we don't own anything anymore. The government does. And he's ultimately kind of correct. Peons can't own property. At least if they were slaves in the land, right? At the end of 7 years, they had an expectation. Along comes the Shemitah or the Jubilee or, you know, a lot of things that people think they owned would come back to them. One law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. Well, we don't dwell in the land anymore. Again, none of that matters. Other kind of stuff. Oh, gee, it just all sounds so negative. What do we do? Well, here's North Korea this week conducting an ejection test of a new sub-launched ballistic missile. They've threatened to nuke the United States. Ho-hum. I guess all of that fits because, meanwhile, the president's leaving the borders open and more worried about domestic terrorists with constitutions than North Koreans or other terrorists in, well, pick a country, that have nukes and the ability to launch them. Hey, not to worry. The grid's coming down anyway, right? Somebody will get it. The conclusion. Where are we at? Can we come out? How can we deal with all of this kind of stuff? Well, you know, is it your car? Is it your property? Is it your body? Is it your life? So far as what we've seen in a land that has forgotten him and that has put its trust in man and made flesh his strength, I guess we shouldn't be surprised. I'm going to suggest to you, too, that when you go back and read this this set of, well, curses, 7 times 7 times 7, in the Torah part of the portion for this week, and then compare that with the Haftorah and Jeremiah, and the judgments that were pronounced against both kingdoms, north and south, and why has all this stuff come upon us? Us is plural. But then it says, yeah, thus says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, cursed is the man who trusts in man, whose heart departs from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. These are singular things, right? That does not sound to me like a national judgment. It may be that all of those people gathered together are going to be cursed uniformly and consistently and collectively. Fine. But if the question is, what do we do about it? What can we do about it? It's about understanding. It says, blessed is the man who trusts in Yahuwah and whose hope is in Yahuwah. He gets to be like a tree, spread out those roots by the waters. Folks, let's do that. And bear in mind that, you know, as the people that were listening in or on the mountain Sinai either knew or didn't know, guess ultimately it didn't matter. Their carcasses were going to all fall in the wilderness. Hundreds of thousands of them, arguably millions. All of those that were essentially mature adults. Dead. Well, not quite. With two exceptions, Joshua and Caleb. They didn't die in the wilderness. They entered the land. What did they do? What set them apart? Answer? Who they trusted in? Remember the story, right? 10 out of the 12, they were outvoted. Oh, can't possibly win. Oh, it's so... Oh, gosh, Giants! Oh, man! Oh, whine, whine, whine! Moan, moan, moan! We are so doomed! Well, I guess you could call that a self-fulfilling prophecy. I picture Caleb like a little happy puppy dog. No, no, no. Let's go on down. Let's get him. Let's get him. We can get him. We can do it. We can do it right now. Come on. Let's go. Let's go. Let's get him today. We'll go. Good job, Caleb. He made it. They didn't. The difference is in an individual attitude. It's about an individual attitude of obedience as opposed to rebellion and where you put your trust. We can still do that today, folks. We can still come out. Again, that doesn't mean that there aren't bad things going to happen to good people. I'm not claiming that. And I'm not claiming that those things that are mandated in the land are necessarily mandated here. But the question remains, can we see the pattern? Can we see the pattern with Joshua and Caleb? Can we be forest people, even if by nature a lot of us are tree people? Can we learn to step back, see the bigger pattern, recognize the instruction, not get confused by the trees that seem to block our view? There are lots and lots of patterns in Scripture. This Torah portion is full of them. And the more we study it, the more we try to walk it out, I will suggest, too, sometimes an amazing thing happens, right? You've heard it. Deja vu. Hey, have I seen this before? Why? Where is this thing that seems similar to other things in the past? It's true. And for most of us, it is true, too, that if you will try to walk it out, and you do it several times, whether it's keeping Sabbath, patterns of seven, or other kinds of things, after a while, you will start to see patterns where you didn't before. Whether it's people talking about Mashiach or any other number of things, I will suggest that a reason why a large number of people just plain miss the promises of Scripture is because they're too focused on saying this can't be something, when in fact, open your eyes. Yeah, it can. Recognize the pattern. And let Yah be your instructor. Let His Word be not a complete blueprint alone. Yeah, let your mind soar a little bit. Step back. Try to soar above the forest and look at the bigger picture. And in the process, come out of her and do the best you can to walk in obedience and don't be fooled by the fake gods. And finally, be bold enough to stand up and speak the truth. When you see bad stuff happening, let folks know. We do have a collective obligation on a national level. We may not have national exposure or the ability, because if they shut the web down and say we're not net neutral, right? All of those stuff is going to be more difficult to do. But we can still, and should be still, doing what it is that we ought to be doing. So with that, I pause and say, any other final questions? If not, we'll wrap it up and we'll pray. Then let's pray. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad. Abba, we know. We know that we have been deceived. We know that this deception that we can see coming is huge, and it's pervasive. And the forest is full of deception. And trees that maybe aren't even trees in some cases. So, Father, we pray that you'd help us. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Make our paths straight, even when we can't see, beyond the little lamp, your Torah that guides our feet for the next step or two. So help us to be able to take, step by step, the path that you'd have for us. Father, we know, too, that there are national things and there are individual things, and that you do speak to us individually. We pray that you would do that. Give us each individually eyes to see. Show us your truth in your word. Where there are things that we need to have information or witnesses so that we can make decisions that are in accord with your plan for our lives as individuals, we pray that you'd guide us. Give us those experiences. Bring those people into our lives that we can do that. We pray furthermore that when we can be witnesses to others, that you'd make those meetings happen so that we can blow the shofar, so that we can, in fact, help our brothers in the ways that we ought to be doing. Help us to come out of the things that we need to come out of and to avoid the snares and the lies. Father, finally, we lift up our loved ones. We have lots and lots of loved ones, Abba, that are walking in rebellion. Maybe they've read your word. Maybe they don't quite see it, or maybe they just plain don't want to obey. But nevertheless, we love them. We know that your word says, those you love, you chasten. So we pray for your chastening for our loved ones. Let your hand be heavy upon them. Block the paths that lead to destruction, that lead to burning alive in the forest, or whatever the case may be, Father. Help us. Help all of us. Bring our communities together, our houses together, that we can learn and walk in obedience to you and in the way that's pleasing to you, and to speak your truth boldly as we ought to, and be where we need to be, and to be counted worthy to escape all this nasty stuff that we can see coming down. Hide us in the time of trouble, we pray. We thank you, Father, and we praise you. And all of this we ask in your name. Hallelujah. Amen. And Shabbat Shalom.